So I'm Ulrike Wagner. I was born and raised in Berlin and returned to Berlin actually after a long time abroad, mostly in the United States. I studied at the Free University, and I studied North American Studies and Modern German and Medieval German History and Literature. And then I also studied at Johns Hopkins University, which is in Baltimore, Maryland, at the Humanities Center, an interdisciplinary program. And that's where I really got to know the American doctoral kind of PhD system. I had no idea what that was, obviously, because I went to a public, enormous public university with 60,000 students. And I, even though I enjoyed being there, you really have to be self-reliant. I mean, you're responsible for your courses. There just no one helps you out. You have to, it's almost kind of, it's a little bit autonomous, almost anarchic in a way. You have to come up with your own course of study, with your classes. It's a little different now, but when I was there and I started in winter 1999, it was still the old system where we got a magister, and I had to completely design my own path, and there was hardly any advice on the way. And I was always sort of drawn to the smaller classes. That's why I did medieval studies, the more kind of intimate setting, more exchange with the professors. But I also sat in huge lecture halls with 100 people and more. So, and then, yeah, so the United States, that was really sort of a turning point for me academically, because that's when I decided to go on with my studies, and where I found my topic, my research topic, or the initial ideas for the research topic. That's what I got in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University. I thought, well, there's so many similarities between German Romanticism and American Transcendentalism. American Transcendentalism is the first major cultural movement in America. And so I decided to apply for a PhD program at Columbia University, then moved to New York. And upon completion of my studies at the Free University in 2005, I started my dissertation. Well, you don't start with your dissertation immediately. You basically go through a whole course of study again. You take classes, you write papers, you have to pass very like exams, and then you actually get started. I both know the American and the German system really well, and the advantages and disadvantages in sort of both fields of education, which I find very interesting and very useful, especially here when I talk to students who also might be interested to take classes at the Free University or at Humboldt University, Technical University. It's nice to also know what a liberal arts college education is about, because I taught at Trinity College in Hartford, which is a small liberal arts college, very similar in terms of size and orientation to Bard College. I mean, it's a different student body, but nevertheless, the overall educational concept is the same. So, and most Germans don't really know what a liberal arts education, what that even is. In a way, it's part of my research. So I'm interested in the rise of the liberal arts college idea in the 18th century. But I also experienced it as a teacher in the US, and it's something that developed in Germany partly in the 18th century, but it's never something that was institutionalized here. It only started to really flourish in early 19th century in America, as you know, with small colleges at that point, like Harvard, for instance. It was just a very small school, nothing spectacular that happened much later. So so that's my background, and I really like the sort of this going back and forth also between the United States and Germany. What also helps here at Bard College Berlin is that I'm a native Berliner, and that I sort of constantly in my own research and in my life work with these two worlds, or two kind of different cultures. I try to somehow bring them in together productively. Thank you. my research really began with questions. It began with the question, for instance, how come that we sit in a seminar room together and that we talk, that we even sit around the table, the organization of the seminar room, where is this coming from? It's not a natural development. It's not always been like this. How come that there is a professor who has sort of enters into a dialogue with his students? Why do we try, for instance, not to have a hierarchy between the professor and the students? We want this atmosphere where we all learn from each other. Again, that's not something that's automatically given. That developed over a long period of time. So a question like that, or another question from a completely different field. How come that even in the 18th century, artists and poets turn to common objects? Like, why, to be more specific, could someone like Emerson say in his essay, The Poet, that the railway, like that a picture is not disturbed by the appearance or the presence of a factory village? So how could that happen? What had to happen in people's brains in order to have this new aesthetic of a commonplace and of and this beginning of an evaluation of common objects that must have started somewhere? Or again, a different field in religion. Like, how did we start to no longer go to church, but to assume that revelation can be found in nature everywhere? Anything can become a springboard, potentially for a divine relation. It can be out there on the Boston Commons. It can be out in the field, in nature, on the street. We no longer need the church for that. We don't need the institution of the church. So you see, sort of from the field of education, art, religion, or just to be maybe a little more general, just concepts of subjectivity closely linked to that, sort of that where the subject is the center and begins to determine what is truth. It's no longer just something that you're automatically being sort of raised with. It's something you continuously question and have to find anew. So, and then of course, as you can imagine, there you can come at this from multiple angles, from any discipline. And what I found to be one of the most interesting was the rise of historical criticism in Germany, particularly as it developed in the field of biblical studies and ancient modern discourses. So the relationship between the present and the past, how do we relate back to Greece? You know that from your classes. There's always that felt inferiority, especially in the 18th century, toward a long distant past. And the question is always, how do we relate back? Both relate back to that past while also finding our own voice. And in religious studies, you find something kind of structurally similar. Yeah, you want to somehow build a connection again to God, but without losing your self-confidence, your authority. Your newly found voice, especially in the Enlightenment. So critical studies were really crucial. The finding, for instance, that the Bible is a book that was not divinely inspired, but a product of different sources, that has a very complex history attached to it. And the same with Greek artworks, or say with Homer. Well, we don't know who the author of the Odyssey was. Probably multiple authors. So it's based on sort of an oral tradition. Again, once you find out that there's not this one authority in the past that you need to follow, but you see that this is also a product of sort of multiple people, and that sort of developed over a long time and generations, you start to feel a little better about yourself. So maybe we in our own time don't have to feel inferior to what came before, but can kind of claim our own voice by both sort of reconnecting with what we have and by also looking at what we are surrounded by. And that is very much sort of this newly found self-confidence is closely connected to the rise of a historical consciousness or a different historical consciousness. So you see, now come back to the question of art that I started out with. Now you can see why someone like Emerson would start to find the factory village interesting, because he starts sort of to study history, see that history or art is closely connected to your, to the world and that you inhabit and that you engage. And then you think, well, the ancients did that in their own world. This past is gone. I live in my own time. And now I turn to whatever I find myself surrounded by and turn that into something aesthetically appealing and interesting. Once you start accepting that there's not just this one authority, or say a priest, or say, yeah, a sort of a higher church authority who tells you what a certain religious text means. Once you see this also as a expression of a religious experience at a specific time, you assume that, well, like, what does that person have to tell me? He might assist me, but he cannot tell me what, how to read, how to understand a text. That somehow diminishes the hierarchy between you and, say, yeah, a church authority. The Protestant religion, for instance, there you can see clearly see how that came about and what kind of huge impact research had. Transfer that same model to an educational institution, you see why a professor does not have the authority to tell you how to really read and understand the text. We can assist you, we can stir your attention or try to direct your attention into certain directions and try to formulate an answer together in conversation, but it would just be weird to place ourselves above our students. There's no basis for that. And that kind of thinking requires a certain, yeah, enlightened thinking in a way that you see developing in the 18th century. And for me, that really was sort of the key. And so it's very closely connected to what I do in my classes or how I teach the Romantic movement. It's hard for me till this very day to talk about, if you ask me a personal question about national identity as such. I think for me it's more connection to places, to people, to the language. It's more kind of a cultural identity and not so much a political one. And now you might want to say, well, it's also kind of a cliche about the Kultur, to the concept of culture in 18th century. That is true, but in that way, I would still say that even in my own life, this is what counts and sort of what is happening on a daily basis. How do I... So for instance, here at Bard College Berlin, I found an ideal environment to do exactly what I want to do. And we haven't talked about this yet, but language teaching is also a huge part of that. Because you can really, I mean, you don't have to convince students normally why they have to learn, why it's very useful to know the language. Because they've already, once you've made the decision to study here, it almost goes without saying that to a certain degree, you're also interested in the language and in the culture. So in other words, when I draw out connections to them, like Berlin, I tell them about places in Berlin, they can actually immediately go off and visit them, which is very nice. At the more advanced levels, I try to integrate literature or sort of introduce literary texts. So this semester, for instance, I teach a B1 class and we look at human-animal relations in poems and short texts. And it's nice because I selected a bunch of very short poems that are difficult. So say by Kafka, even like a short text is really hard, but it's manageable, right? Because it's so short. And the same with poetry. So we looked at a poem by Rilke, again, a difficult poem, but short enough for students to really invest the time and translate and engage with it and take it sort of as a starting point to write something about the poem. And here I really value their the courage to talk over, say, grammatical issues or like or grammatical correctness. That's sort of a secondary concern. My primary concern is really to get people talking and to get people into a conversation. Yeah, so we try to really do both. We do very focused work where we where I try to say, look, this is the structure I want you to use, the grammatical structure and nothing else. And then we also have what I call like freestyle, where really the point is just to say whatever it is you want to say in your language at that time and to get your point across. And I think that's very important because you you kind of freshen things up a little bit, and you also show students by doing that how much often they know a lot more than they think they do, or they can say a lot more than they think they can. And if you take the pressure off, it happened a couple of times this semester already that we had ended up having a really interesting discussion about Kafka or Rilke, or we started with Lessing. So we looked at a small fable by Lessing. Again, fables are great because they're short and you really can talk a lot.